Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
My Family Recipe is a new podcast from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network, bringing you cherished heirloom recipes and the stories behind them. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, hello, welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and it is Thursday, November 18th, 2021. This is our 309th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is a wonderful writer, editor, and former lieutenant to the late, great Anthony Bourdain, and I will introduce her fully in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to find healing through work. Yes, this one's a little bit deep, but fact is, we all have stuff, and we need to find ways to deal with it. And it's possible that our work can be therapeutic if we allow it to. It can serve a purpose beyond the task at hand, providing comfort on another level. So whatever we may be going through, let's remember that we can seek solace and find healing even in the most unexpected places. That's my tip today. Now, I'm thrilled to have my guest joining me. It is Lori Wolliver. She is a writer, an editor, and for nearly a decade, former lieutenant to the late author, TV host, and producer, Anthony Bourdain. Lori has written for the New York Times, Vogue, GQ, Food and Wine, Lucky Peach, rest in peace, and more. And she's been a private cook, nanny, caterer, writer, bus girl, and more, and editor at Art Culinaire and Wine Spectator. She's written several books, including Appetites, a Cookbook, and World Travel, and A Reverend Guide, which she co-authored with Anthony Bourdain, which and the latter entered the New York Times bestseller list at number one. And she's most recently written Bourdain, the definitive oral biography, which debuted at number seven on the New York Times bestseller list. So without further ado, hi, Lori. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sherry. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me. Yeah, I'm really excited to chat with you. And I was thinking back to when we met, and I feel like it was during your Art Culinaire days.
That's very possible. Was it in a bookstore in like a Williams-Sonoma bookstore, or am I misremembering that?
The exact detail of it, I'm not sure. Your memory is probably better than mine on that. I just remember you working there, and just as a PR person in relationship with writer, just kind of knowing that was what your beat was. Mm-hmm. But let's go back a little bit to a bit of your history or how you got into your career, which I named some of the past jobs you've had, but you certainly have done a lot of things. So you want to take us back a little bit to how you got started?
Sure, absolutely. So my first sort of real food job, well, really going back, I was a bus girl in a restaurant when I was a teenager, which was a kind of a formative experience and certainly a lot of fun. And sort of as much as I didn't really love it at the time, it did sort of, there was something about the restaurant business that I did love. I loved the sort of excitement and the chaos and the teamwork and, you know, the end of the night kind of relaxing with my coworkers. But my first job out of college was as a private cook for a family. And doing that, I loved it, but I wanted to actually really learn how to cook. I didn't have any training at that point, so I decided to go to the French Culinary Institute and got my classic culinary certificate there, their 6-month professional program. And then from there, it was very clear to me that I wasn't really cut out to be a restaurant cook, that I didn't really have the temperament, or I just didn't love it enough. I wasn't passionate enough to make all the sort of sacrifices that one, I think, has to make to be a happy, successful line cook in New York. So I applied to be Mario Batali's assistant, and this was in 1998. He wasn't yet the huge celebrity that he would become. And I think I was the only person who applied for it. And, the fact that I had just graduated culinary school, so I knew my way around food a little bit, and I wanted to be a writer, and I was willing to kind of do whatever, job came up. It made me, I think, an attractive candidate. But I think I was the only person who applied for the job. So I was hired, and I did that for 3.5 years. And that really was an education in all things restaurant and food and wine, travel, media, business, real estate. It was just this unbelievably immersive experience to be, at the right hand of somebody who was really an up and coming figure in all those worlds in New York in the late 90s and early 2000s. So that's really where I think things kind of got started for me. Mario was willing to kind of put me in touch with people who could help me out getting started writing and editing for magazines and newspapers. And I helped him write 2 cookbooks while I worked for him. And from there, I was a freelance writer and editor. And then after about 2 years of that and cobbling together catering gigs and private cooking and really kind of just treading water when it came to keeping my bills paid, quite frankly, and not, maxing out my credit card, I decided to take a job at Art Culinaire. I didn't really feel qualified for it, but I thought, well, let me see, maybe they'll hire me. And they did, to my great surprise. And so I went from being a freelance writer to suddenly being, executive editor of a magazine. Of course, it was an extremely small staff. It wasn't like I was, producing a monthly glossy for Condé Nast. It was a quarterly with almost no ads and, very much a niche publication, but one that's very beloved and respected by chefs, certainly, and people in the business. And so I learned a lot working there, and I got to travel, and I got to meet a lot of really incredible chefs and inspiring cooks. And then from there, I went to Wine Spectator because I was eager to get back into New York. I lived in New York, and I was commuting out to Morristown, New Jersey every day to work at Art Culinaire. And that just, that got sort of old after a while. So I was really lucky to get hired at Wine Spectator. I did that for a number of years. I got a whole education in wine, winemakers, terroir, just the business of wine and a closer look at the business of magazine publishing. But my beat was really more about food and wine pairing, recipe stuff. I was always, on the food side of things, but got a really good general education in wine. And then I had a child and I wanted to kind of change the way that I was working and the way I was using my time. And that's when I started working for Tony Bourdain. I was able to work from home. And I had, having been an assistant to Mario Batali, again, Tony was very willing to hire me just based on that job experience. And we had worked together on his first cookbook, Anthony Bourdain's Layal cookbook. So he knew that we could work well together and that, that I was someone that he could trust. And so I did that job for close to 10 years. And in that time, we wrote a cookbook, as you said, Appetites. And we started working on World Travel, which is a book that I had to finish in the wake of his unexpected death in 2018.
Wow. Yes. Thank you for taking us through. I mean, it's interesting to me a little with careers. Like for me, after college, I lived in Chicago and I went to a cooking school in Chicago. I did a small culinary program thinking I wanted to be a chef and then realizing that maybe that wasn't my calling. But, and then I dabbled in a lot of different things along my my career path with recipe testing and food styling and all these things until I eventually found PR. So it's interesting. There's a little similarity, but difference in definitely your work with getting plugged in with Mario. And then getting to wine, when you talked about Wine Spectator, I was thinking one of my most memorable internships, or really put me in foot in the door, was I was an intern at Food Arts magazine, which
Food Arts under the umbrella of M. Shankin Communications.
Yeah. And also really well respected like industry publication, like our culinaire. So it's interesting to see, like, I mean, hearing people's career paths and how we end up where we are. How did you initially meet Tony? Was it through Mario?
Yeah, I was getting ready to end my time as Mario's assistant, and Tony had published Kitchen Confidential a few years before that. We, of course, everyone read it and loved it, and so I knew who he was. And then Tony and Mario became friends, and Tony reached out to Mario and said, "Listen, I have to, I'm writing a cookbook now. Can you recommend anyone to help me edit and test recipes? I don't really have time to do all that myself, nor do I, really know what that work is like." And so Mario recommended me and made that introduction. And so Tony hired me, I think based on either a phone call, or I might've actually sent him a letter. We never met in person before he hired me to do the job. It was based on the strength of Mario's recommendation. And then we finally did meet in person once, the book got underway, so that we could kind of just, have a quick meeting and figure out our workflow. So that was in 2002 was the first time that I met him.
Yeah. Well, I have my copy of Kitchen Confidential here. Of course, read it like everyone else. But I followed and knew, I'd met Tony, I think, a couple times, but I didn't really know him. But what was it like working for him, and how did your role change over the years? And also seeing his career, take off is like an understatement, right?
Yeah, when I first met him and worked with him on that book, I was very surprised. I think, like most people, having read the book, I just thought he was going to be this kind of cowboy, energy dialed up to 10, just like a wild man and very irreverent and loud. And that wasn't at all the case. I was really surprised to see he was kind of quiet and shy and a little awkward in a way that I wasn't sure, like, is it me or is it him? We had a very professional and rather brief, meeting about the book with his co-authors at Leal Restaurant. And then from then on, it was mostly everything we did by email. We just, passed recipes back and forth and notes, and because he was already so busy. So that was my first impression of him. And it was pretty much the same, once I started as his assistant, I got to know him a little bit better. But, over time, he was such a busy person, constantly on the move, that for the first year or two, I really didn't see him very much in person at all. And to the fact that I sort of would make fun of him about this. There was a time, it was maybe a year and a half into working for him, and I was invited to some kind of a party at his production company. I think it was a wrap party for the season. And so I went and I had to introduce myself to him. Like, he didn't remember what I looked like. And he, and he meets so many people, and it wasn't a surprise, but he was embarrassed, and it was just sort of something we laughed about. But
that's funny.
He was at once he was very open and very not shy about saying what he needed, and I sort of, as an assistant, you kind of jump into someone's life and you know what they're. Doctor's appointments are, and what they're doing in their free time, and where they're traveling, and what they need for their household, all these things. But he, and I wrote, this comes up a lot in the book Bourdain. He also was a very private person in some ways, and so I felt in some ways that I knew him very well, and in some ways that there was just there were things behind a locked door that were not for me or maybe for anyone to know. So, you know, we had a really good working relationship. I really tried to just be professional and efficient. And, you know, I like to be funny. I like to talk to people. I like to be social, but I felt like this guy is constantly coming into contact with a public who worships him and who is, you know, wants to impress him, wants to get his attention. And the last thing he needs is me, you know, trying to make jokes and you know, be like that. So I always really erred on the side of staying quiet and just sort of being very businesslike. As time went on, I got a little more relaxed and I felt like I was able to kind of be more myself around him. But I just didn't ever want to be the burden, to add to the burden in any way, because I think it what really was, as much as I think he really enjoyed his life and the experiences and the opportunities that he had, I think it also, you know, it takes a lot out of you to be a public figure like that. And especially one who sort of part of his persona was everyman, right? In some ways. So I think people really relate to that. They want to talk to you more than, you know, they're not as intimidated as they might be by a, you know, a big A-list actor. And so that takes more out of you when you're out in the public.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know what it's like to be a celebrity or that famous at that level. And he is someone who came across or as someone that, yeah, you could be buddies with and just want to chat. And it had to be very hard. And I think you're what you know, you said, or the way you took on working with him, obviously was the right match and fit and what he needed, and worked well, and that you worked together on books, many books together too. So, I give you a lot of credit, and I've been wondering, like, how have you been since his passing? I was, I mean, I'll just share, like, I feel like it's for someone who knew him or knew of him or in the industry, like, it's kind of like you remember where you were when you heard the news. And yeah. I remember for me, I was on my way, I was walking in Manhattan down to Sullivan Street Bakery because they were one of my clients and we had a photo shoot, and I was looking at my phone and I was on Instagram, and all of a sudden I started seeing posts about him. And I was like, why is everyone posting about Tony Bourdain? Mm. And I just remember like showing up there and like telling Jim Leahy, and it was just. It was like, I'm just thinking about it. I'm like just getting the chills kind of thinking about it. So
it's a tough thing to metabolize. You know, it's been 3.5 years now. So I've certainly had some time to reflect on it, and to, you know, to have written these books really was a gift in a lot of ways, to be able to continue to kind of work with him in a way, even though he's not around, but to have a mandate to do something with all of this wonderful work that he left behind, and to talk to so many people that were part of his life, get their stories, hear their thoughts about him, hear their memories. A lot of people I had never met before or wasn't even aware of who they were before Tony died. I was able to meet with many of them, interview them for Bourdain. So I feel lucky in a way that my grieving period also was a period of productive work, and that, you know, I didn't have to just sort of change gears and say, okay, well, I need a new job now. You know, my boss is dead. I think that would have been a much more difficult transition. So how am I? You know, I'm okay. I mean, there's a lot of processing that goes on in any death, right? But especially I think with a suicide, where there is this different sense of how one might have done something differently. And it's a bit of a fool's errand, because there is no changing the outcome of what happened. There is no changing the trajectory and the decision that a person makes to end their life. It's a very, it's a finite thing, obviously. So, but there, you can't help but go over and over those last few days or last, you know, interactions and talking to people, and always just sort of wondering like what could have been done different? What could I have done differently? Or what could have anyone done differently? If only this, if only that, you know, it's a lot of processing. So Yeah, it's complicated. You know, I feel very lucky. I have a really great therapist, and I have a lot of great friends and family. And Tony surrounded himself with some of the best people, you know, the most loyal, the smartest, the hardest working, the funniest. And so to have that web of people who were also deeply, deeply affected by this death, and to be able to lean on them and talk to them and ask them questions and just sort of get together and hold each other up, which I think we all continue to do to an extent. You know, life moves on. People had to find other work and figure out how to move on with their lives. But, you know, I just had lunch the other day with one of Tony's producers, you know, and he said, we got to just stick together and help each other out and, you know, keep this thing going, as far, you know, this thing being, you know, the extraordinary people that Tony surrounded himself with. Not to flatter myself, but, you know, the people that worked for him on television and the people that were his publishing partners, I mean, just, you know, truly making outstanding work. And Tony obviously was the center of that, but you can't make a TV show in isolation. You can't publish, you know, a book in print in isolation. And he was really good at figuring out how to motivate people, how to get great work out of people. So I feel very lucky to have those people in my life still.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. And I think it's really wonderful that you have this book that's out now, on Bourdain, which I have here as well. And it's, I've been reading through it, not in order, I guess. I kind of been jumping around, and I think you can, the way it's designed, by the different chapters, are just, it's amazing how you have so many, different people that knew him quoted in the book. Mm-hmm. How did you go about putting it together? Did you reach out to people and just let them, I guess, just share information, or did you give them specific topics to talk about?
Each person that I interviewed, I tried to really educate myself as much as possible about their relationship with Tony, or, you know, anything I could find out about people before I went into the interview. I used every interview I had written questions, and a lot of times, you know, we would deviate from those, and just, you know, the conversation would become kind of a more organic process. But I always went in prepared to do a straight interview, because you never know. Some people are very good at just talking off the cuff and volunteering information, and some people need a little, you know, a little or a lot more prompting. And so I tried to be as prepared as possible, you know, talking to people who knew those people, you know, reading, going back and reading Kitchen Confidential and Medium Raw, and even Tony's fiction, his crime novels, and you know, just scouring all of the available material for anything that I could. And people were just really, you know, I think Tony made such an impression on the world and also on specific people. So it was really astounding to me the amount of very specific, visceral detail that people were able to pull up. In some cases from, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, from high school experiences, from you know, Tony's brief stint as a college student, from the CIA, from his time in the kitchens of New York City in the 80s and 90s. People had lots and lots of very specific, detailed memories of funny things he said or did, or, you know, just great experiences with him, things they learned from him as a cook and as a chef. So it was really, you know, for me, one of the big challenges was how to choose what to leave in. And you know, I couldn't include everything, obviously. And I had there are 91 people in the book. I interviewed probably closer to 100. There were a few that for whatever reason just weren't a natural fit for the book. But so that's probably, you know, close to 200 hours of recorded conversation. And so I really had to focus in. The most logical sort of scheme to set up the book was chronological, which it is. But like you said, you don't have to read it in order. You know, each chapter kind of is its own discrete segment of his life that you can skip around. And they're short chapters, which I think really helps a person kind of move along in any reading scenario.
Yeah. For someone like me, it was, I have a lot of books in my, I have a hard time sitting down and getting through a whole book because I jump around so much. So yes, the short chapters work for me as well. And I also love, I didn't expect it until I opened it, but I love the photos that are in the book. They're very special of Tony and his family and just a lot of really cool memories.
Yeah. You know, his mother, Gladys, who was interviewed in the book, she did die herself in January of 2020. I was able to interview her in the fall of 2018. And she was an extraordinary archivist for the family photos and papers and everything. She was a copy editor at the New York Times for 25 years. So she's an extremely, she was an extremely meticulous person, very exacting. And she kept a wonderful selection of photos in the, you know, probably 30 family photo albums, and each one labeled with the date, with the first and last name of every person in the photo, the location, you know, what was the occasion. Just she made my work so easy. So Tony's brother Christopher now has all of those photos, and he was really very generous in letting me come and look through everything and make some selections for the book. And again, it was the case of, God, if I had the room in this book, I could put in, you know, several hundred photos, but I did have to narrow it down quite a bit. So I tried to really get a lot of photos that people hadn't seen before. There are some that are, you know, have been in circulation for a while, but there are a lot in the book that I don't think have been seen outside of Tony's family. So, you know, a lot of really cute baby pictures and pictures from his youth. There's a group photo from his summer camp where he is, you can tell exactly which one he is because he's sort of slyly giving the middle finger. you know, and he's got his camp uniform on. I mean, he looks all, you know, he looks very innocent. And then you look at his face and you look at his lap and both of his hands, he's got this middle finger sticking up. I'm like, oh my God, this kid at 11 years old, this kid was already, you know, he was who he was.
So funny. I'm looking at the book and I just found the picture. it's awesome. Everyone get this book. It's a great, I mean, for the pictures and for the content, it's terrific. And you also finished the book that you had, I believe, started working on with Tony, The World Travel and Irreverent Guide.
That's right.
Which I need to get my hands on a copy of that. I don't have it, but I tell me a little bit about what that was like finishing it in the process.
Sure. So that one, we started talking about it and planning it in 2017. And it was a bit of a slow process because Tony, of course, was so busy and traveling all the time. And it just took a while for everything to kind of get settled with the contract. And then once we got that started, that was probably spring of 2018 when we really got down to work. And so we had this one meeting where I went in with a list of every place he had ever gone for television. And in some cases, you know, other reasons. And we just went through it. And it was, you know, it was not everywhere in the world, but many, many places in the world, you know, every continent and many countries within those continents. And of course, lots and lots of domestic locations. And we just went through all of them and decided, you know, what can we make a chapter out of? Where are there enough places to recommend that it would make an interesting travel book chapter? And he had lots of ideas. He had lots of very clear memories and very strong opinions about places and what you know he would like to include and what he doesn't want to include. And I recorded that conversation, and that ended up being the only meeting we ever had about the book. You know, I took the notes from that conversation and got to work on, you know, constructing the framework of the book and started diving into old episodes and reading all the old transcripts. And then it was, you know, maybe 2 months later when he was gone. So we hadn't got too deep into the process. And then suddenly it was just mine to finish and to decide whether or not to finish it. And there was definitely a period where I thought, I don't know if I can do this. You know, this is so painful and it's so not what I expected. You know, I had written appetites with him a few years before that. It was such a joyful experience. It was so much fun and so hilarious. And, you know, he had a million creative ideas. He had such a hand in every part of making the book. The photos are weird and funny. And, you know, it was just a really incredible experience. So that was what I was expecting from world travel. And then to suddenly be, you know, hit with this tremendous grief and shock and then have to make something that was uplifting and joyful and useful and funny. It felt like an insurmountable task. And then after a few months, I thought, well, you know, what else am I going to do? You know, let me give this a try and see if I can make a go of it on my own. And so as much as I'm very proud of the book, and I think it is, I think it's useful and funny, and whether or not you'll ever travel, I think it's a really, it's a great way to learn a lot about the world. The process of making it, especially in those early few months, was very, very lonely because it was not what I had expected. And, you know, it was a lot of writing, a lot of research. It's a solitary pursuit to be a writer. And especially with this kind of book, yeah, where I just had to dive into the material, you know, whereas with Bourdain, a lot of times I was in company because I was constantly talking to people. But I'm very proud of World Travel. It did extraordinarily well. You know, it came out, it was the first sort of thing that came out this year that was something quote unquote new from Tony Bourdain. And so I think there was this tremendous amount of pent up desire for something. And also it was at a time when vaccines were just starting to roll out and we were starting to actually feel that maybe we could travel again. So we were very lucky with the timing. And I think it is full of Tony's writing, this book. So I think it does give people sort of a new bit of Tony, even if it's things that he said on television or things that he had written elsewhere, it's put together in a way that it feels very fresh.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you did it, and congratulations. That's amazing. Let me ask you my question from my last guest on episode 308. I had on Chris Cardone. He's a bartender with over 21 years of experience who currently is bartending at Isodi in New York City. And he's the 2017 national champion of Diageo World Class. So he wants to know, what's your interpretation of what Anthony's intention really was with all of his shows and the information that he gave us all? What do you think he was trying to accomplish? And he noticed that he seemed very authentic on his shows. And yes, I agree with that.
What do I think he was trying to accomplish? Well, you know, speaking very frankly, and this gets addressed in the book Bourdain, I think he had this, at least at first, I think he had this sense of the brass ring only comes around once. You know, he had published Kitchen Confidential. He suddenly was hugely in demand, people offering TV shows and publishing contracts and you know, promoting products, and suddenly he was a hot commodity in the world. And I think he thought, well, this is, you know, I've told in obscurity for close to 30 years as a cook, and I'm a frustrated writer, and I'm gonna take this opportunity. And he was actually quite ambivalent about being a television personality. I think it really, and again, this is discussed at length in the book Bourdain, where he felt sort of embarrassed by being on television, and he felt sort of like a fraud. But it was like, well, I'll never forgive myself if I don't take this opportunity and ride it to the end and see, you know, what I can make of this life. So I think that was his initial intent, honestly, was to take advantage of this extraordinary opportunity. And I think as time went on, and I think as he realized how much fun it could be to make television, to sort of be more a filmmaker than a television producer and host, I think he started to understand that he had creative ideas and visions that he could execute through this medium of television, and that he could tell stories, and that he could, in a non-didactic way, that he could maybe help people to understand more of the world, just as, you know, he had his own sort of education and awakening. You know, he's somebody who really hadn't traveled very much at all when he started making television. He had been to France a few times with his family. He spent some time in the Caribbean. And then he had a solo one trip to Tokyo when he was the chef at Leal. And that was the one that sort of, you know, broke open his brain and was like, oh my God, there's so much of the world I haven't seen yet, you know? So I think, you know, as he matured as a television presence, I think the intention became, let me help other people to see all the good and the bad and the difference and the sameness and the beauty and the ugliness of the world, just the way that, you know, that I've been able to see it through this extraordinary stroke of good luck.
Yes. I mean, so well said. And yeah, we're going to take a break. I just also wanted to mention that you also, during this time, produced Roadrunner, or were a producer on Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain, a documentary, which I did go see and really enjoyed it. I mean, it's, you know, it's emotional, I think, watching it, but I think it's awesome that you were involved with that as well.
Yeah, I felt really lucky to be involved. You know, the filmmakers are obviously hugely talented people. Morgan Neville is an Oscar winner for his film 20 Feet from Stardom. So he was a really excellent choice to do this one. And I think they really did him justice. You know, it's such a beautiful film. It just broke my heart wide open when I saw it for the first time. I was really glad to be watching a cut of it at home and not in a theater, you know, snuffling all over everyone. And it's very, very emotional. And, you know, I've saw it at Tribeca, and then I saw it a few times in theaters just because I wanted to sort of experience it in the, you know, in the wild. And it really had a deep, deep emotional impact on people. It was very, it was beautiful and exciting, and also really kind of sad and painful to see, just see Tony kind of reanimated, and in some cases to see this footage that no one had seen before, you know, the footage that was shot in France in the last few days of his life. And it's very, very moving film. And I encourage people to see it and you know, put tissues in their pockets.
I agree. And it got me back to movie theaters. I think it's actually the only movie I've been back to now since. Because I go when there's something I really want to see, and I didn't really want to see it and recommend it for people. So, okay, awesome. Let's take a little break. We'll come back. We'll play my speed round game. We'll talk some industry news. I have my solo dining experience and the final question. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
Good food is worth a thousand words. This is Aarti Menon, and I'm delighted to share a new podcast with you. My Family Recipe. From Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network. Adapted from Food 52's much-loved column of the same name, the My Family Recipe podcast will bring its pages to life. Each episode of My Family Recipe brings you a cherished heirloom recipe and the story behind it, from voices across the world of food.
We'd open these tubs of dough, and they would exhaust these incredible yeasty fumes, and it just smelled like nothing else. It was so intoxicating.
I'll interview writers and chefs, parents and children, about what's passed down along with the foods that we know and love.
Chinese people aren't like born with a download on how to like velvet chicken. You know, like that's not something that just like comes to you.
Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and my guest today is Lori Wooliver. She is a writer, editor, and the former lieutenant to the late author, TV host, and producer Anthony Bourdain. So, Lori, it's time for my speed round game. What this is I'm going to name a couple things, and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, here we go. Eat in at home or eat out at a restaurant?
Eat in at home. Sorry.
There's no right or wrong. There's no right or wrong. Indoor dining or al fresco dining?
Indoor dining.
Wine, beer, cocktail, mocktail, or champagne?
Mocktail.
Nice. How about tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
Large plates.
Love it. Communal table or chef's counter?
Oh, I hate them both. Chef's counter.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, you can sit at a table by your without.
Yeah.
Your own individual table is fine.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a few more. Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Oh, God. Tipping. I don't know. Whatever is better for the people.
Excellent. Okay, writing, reading, or podcasting?
Writing.
Cool. Travel by plane, train, or automobile?
Train.
My last two are cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert.
Manhattan or Brooklyn, or for you, I'm saying, or Queens.
Queens.
I always just say Manhattan or Brooklyn. I'm like, I have to give Lori Queens a choice in this.
Yes, yes. Always Queens.
Here's to Queens. That's awesome. And that was the game.
All right. What do I win? Just kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to come up with better prizes than the fact that you're going to win to continue on with me and talk some industry news.
Great.
I know. Super exciting. So the article I picked out was in Fast Company, and it's entitled Gourmet Marketplace Gold Belly is Launching a TV Channel, Becoming the QVC of Artisanal Food. And this was by Yasmin Gain. And basically talking about how Gold Belly, which really was a business that thrived during the pandemic, a very important partner for restaurants, allowing them to ship meals and meal kits around the country when dining rooms were closed. This was an idea that the CEO had for a while, Joe Ariel, about launching something on TV. And so Gold Belly TV is a video platform for food e-commerce, and it ties directly with like their talent and the products that they offer. And I checked it out the other day. It's like eat what you watch, and I think it's really cool. I think it's smart. What's your take? Do you know anything about this?
No, this is news to me. But I think anything that helps restaurants and artisanal food producers to get the word out there, to keep themselves open, to keep themselves sustained, you know, in this time that's been so devastating for the business, I think is in theory a great thing, you know. And you know, I have some trepidation about shipping food around the country when maybe there are good options in your backyard that don't involve the same carbon footprint and packaging. And, you know, there are issues of waste and of, you know, mileage and trucks and airplanes and all that. But, you know, to be very realistic, this is a model that's not going away, right? Amazon is not going away. The e-commerce is here to stay. So if it's something like Gold Belly, where it's, you know, super high quality, really great stuff that makes people happy, and again, that helps restaurants and producers stay viable, then I'm all for it. You know, will I be ordering food off television? Probably not, but I don't know that I'm really I don't think I'm the target demographic. And I will be doing food gifts this year. You know, I have someone to buy for who's very difficult, and he said, well, you know, food is always a safe bet. So, you know, it's not the worst idea in the world. And, you know, if we continue to not be able to travel the way that we would want to, or travel is just not an option for a person, but they're dying for that Katz's pastrami sandwich or, you know, tartine bread or, you know, whatever it is that's being offered on Gold Belly, it's a nice way to feel that even if you can't travel, you're getting a little piece of something from the place that you would like to be. So, you know, I'm on the fence, but ultimately, yeah, you know, let's keep innovating and let people figure out ways to keep their businesses going.
Yeah, I agree completely with what you said. And it's interesting because I dine out and go out all the time. And I personally haven't used Gold Belly because I was thinking, am I the target audience? I mean, I am, I guess, but for some reason I'm more the person physically who wants to go to the places. But this is giving access to this stuff for people, you know, in other cities and all around. And they have different, they have a really nice lineup already with cooking demos with the products. They have like Daniel Ballou's on the site, the Hannah Marianne Chang of Mimi Chang's and Ivan Ramen. And I think I will have to see where this goes, but I agree. I don't think it's going away. And giving people access to food products that they want that they might not be able to access, like you said, a Katz's sandwich is I think a good thing.
So, yeah.
So we'll see. Congratulations to them. It's during such a hard year or two, it is pretty amazing or interesting that some businesses did do very well, and they were certainly one of them. So, mm-hmm. Okay. So it's time for my solo dining experience. So this week it's at Pappy and Harriet's Pioneer Palace. So here's the rundown. 53688 Pioneer Road in Pioneer Town, California, near Joshua Tree. The concept, it's a quintessential high desert roadhouse serving classic American fare amid a rustic Western decor plus barbecue and live music. The current owners since 2003 are Robin Celia and Linda Krantz. Just looking on their website back at the history, it was owned by Pappy and Harriet, and Pappy died in 1994, and Harriet then sold it to a family member who had it a couple years, and then these two new owners took over again in 2003. So why'd I go? Well, I was in Joshua Tree for the first time a couple months ago, and this is a legendary music venue, restaurant, and bar, so I figured I had to go. My experience. So it didn't look like they took reservations. I saw they closed at 9:30, so I made sure to get there before that. I got there around 8:30. The place was happening. There aren't that many dining options, I think, in the Joshua Tree area, but it definitely had a great buzz, and it was cool to see. It was a good vibe. I toured the space a little bit afterward, and I was glad to be there. What did I get? So I got a half rack of baby back ribs. It was smothered in homemade barbecue sauce, and it was 100% pure Berkshire meat, and it had two sides. It had mac and cheese and broccoli. And my take was, it was great. It was really tasty. I mean, the half rack was huge. I mean, it's not like people, I started conversations with people around me when my plate arrived, because it was just ginormous, and it was only a half rack. There was a full rack. So definitely get your dollars worth there. So the ambiance, so it's an iconic roadhouse. It's lots of woods and a big bar and open spaces for performances. It's in the middle of the desert. And actually, before I left town the next day, I decided to like drive through the area to kind of see it more, because at night you really can't see anything. It's just pitch black. But it was cool. I see it. It is like a movie set. I'd say it's perfect place to go dinner with friends. Interesting tidbit, Pappy and Harriet's opened in 1982. And there's a long history with Pioneer Town, with a group of Hollywood investors who had came into the space and wanted to create it into this living movie set. So there's been many films shot there. And also, fun fact about it is, as a music venue, there's Paul McCartney, Lizzo, like lots of very famous performers have performed there. So again, it was good to see the spot. And another interesting tidbit is I saw that Anthony Bourdain filmed an episode of Travel Channel's No Reservations in 2011 in the Mojave Desert, and his first stop was Pappy and Harriet's. So my wrap it up. My personal fun fact is that I stayed for the first time in an Airbnb, and in my first Airstream, it was actually called a magical Airstream, and I absolutely loved it. It was really great for as a solo traveler and just to be in the middle of the desert, and I got to spend some time in Joshua Tree National Park hiking around, and it was a really great trip. So the cost of this meal was $24, not including tax and gratuity. Would I go back? Yes. Their website is poppyandharriets.com, and same Instagram handle, Pappy and Harriet's. So there you go. Have you heard of this place, Lori?
I have. I remember when Tony shot the desert episode in 2011, there was a great scene with him and Josh Homme of Queens of the Stone Age, who's also in the book Bourdain. Interestingly, I have become Instagram friends with a woman named Lisa Elin, and she and her, I believe, boyfriend actually are the, as of September of 2021, they are the new owners of Harry and Pappy and Harriet's. It's a very recent thing, but
well, good to know. They need to their website, because
they do. Yes,
is where I got my info.
Yeah, I just pulled up an article from the Coachella Valley Independent newspaper, because I was like, I think Lisa owns that now. So, yeah, that's very late breaking news, but it is under new ownership. And according to this reviewer and the Coachella Valley Independent, Nothing has changed in terms of the ambiance, the food, the service, the music. They have been very painstaking about making sure that they don't mess up the vibe of a place that people really, really love and has a long history. So I've never been there, but I can co-sign.
Amazing. No, and thank you for the correction on that. I mean, wow, how that's awesome that you knew that. And I want to go back and watch Tony's episode. I knew of the place. It came up when I was looking for restaurants, and then the guys that ran the Airstream I was at were, you know, recommended going there. And especially if you're driving at night, like you sort of just driving, like you don't know where you're going. And then all of a sudden you see the lights of the building and you're like, oh wow, this is amazing. So.
Wow. Yeah. I definitely want to check it out.
Yeah. Well, awesome. Okay. So it's time for the final question. My next guest is Virgilio Martinez. He's the chef and owner of Central in Lima, Peru. Currently number 4 on the world's 50 best list. And he's the author of a new book, The Latin American Cookbook by Fiden. And I was very fortunate to dine at Central. I look back in 2016, I took a trip out to Peru. So, and I've met him. And so I'm excited to chat with him. So Lori, what would you like to ask Virgilio?
Oh gosh. I guess, you know, what is the impact and the pressure of being so high up on the world's 50 best list? Do you think that your guests come in expecting something different or something extraordinary because of the list? How much of your guest population is informed by the list versus people that are just coming because they know that your food is good?
That's a really great question. I look forward to hearing how he answers it, because yeah, there's got to be pressure being mm-hmm. so highly ranked. Mm-hmm. Expectations, right? All about yeah. expectations. So that's great. Before we wrap up, one thing I didn't get a chance to ask you was, what's next? Like, what are you working on now? Anything you want to share?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I have been working for a few months on a book about bread, and that's actually the working title, with the baker Richard Hart, who is a British former chef, now baker. He spent 6 or 7 years as the head baker at Tartine in San Francisco. And a few years ago, he moved to Copenhagen and opened Hart Bakery there in that city under the auspices of the Noma Group. And he is just an extraordinary baker. He makes beautiful bread. He's a funny, he's like the happiest, most well-adjusted person I've ever met, certainly in the food business. He's just this sort of rare gem that's just you know, happy and well-adjusted. It's kind of amazing. And he makes really great bread, and he's a great teacher. I was somebody who really I had never made sourdough before I started working with him on this book. And he's been able to teach me in a very straightforward way how to make great bread. So we are writing that book together. It'll be a cookbook with about 60 recipes, and that's going to be published by Clarkson Potter, probably, I don't know, give us a year or two. So that's what I'm working on now. And I am, you know, always sort of looking for my next book project. I'm starting to do my own kind of personal writing about my experiences in and around the food world, you know, pitching other cookbook ideas. And I've been talking to a few people about various TV projects that are, you know, very much in their infancy, but I'm excited to kind of move into that realm.
Oh, fabulous. That's yeah. wonderful. I met Richard briefly. I went to the MAD conference in Copenhagen a couple of years ago. Mm. So I'm a little bit familiar with him and his bread, and I know it is outstanding. So mm-hmm. that's going to be a terrific book.
Yeah. Thank you. I hope so.
Yeah, I know it will be. And and exciting, like different, kind of a little different beat, like still yeah. under the same umbrella, but a little different.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So. Definitely. I'm also doing public speaking as much as possible. I'm really trying to move into that realm, and it's a little bit terrifying, but it's really, really fun. There's nothing like it to get off after having done a speech, to get off the stage and feel like there's just an incredible high. So as much as I find it a little bit scary, I've been doing it more and more. I've got some dates booked in for 2022. And if anyone wants me to come speak to their cooking school or college class or their corporate retreat or whatever, I am definitely available to speak to your group.
Well, that's wonderful. No, you're a wonderful speaker. I mean, I think that's a great direction. I think that's great for you to be doing. You're a natural.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. Trying.
Yeah, you are. So, and thank you so much for joining me. I'm so impressed with everything you've done. And it's been hard, as we said, yeah. But I'm glad you're doing well and you have all these amazing books out, new projects. I wish you the best.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Lori. My guest today has been Lori Willover. She is a writer and editor and former lieutenant to the late author and TV host and producer Anthony Bourdain. Check out her books. She's got Appetites, World Travel, and Irreverent Guide, both with Anthony Bourdain, and also Bourdain, the definitive oral biography. And you can find out more on her website, loriwilliver.com, and follow her at Lori Willover. You can follow me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR and at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites, BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com, and AllInTheIndustry.com. All of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks to my engineer today, Kevin. Thanks again to Lori. I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bayer. Thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.